quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. Hey, it's Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, and we respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Nations. The show, Typically Tuesdays, is produced on unceded territories of the Catsey, Coquitlam, and Stolo First Nations. And at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers of these lands. At the same time, we also recognize and honor the plights and lives of all colonized people around the globe, with today a particular attention to the horrors that are occurring in Gaza. I want to take this opportunity to express my solidarity, movements around land back, and also my solidarity for a free Palestine. Today's episode of the show is heavily inspired by Radio Al-Hara, which is an online radio provider. They recently did 12 hours of programming on Palestine, and it's called Until Liberation. You can find that actually on SoundCloud if you look up Until Liberation Radio Al-Hara. In the spirit of that and getting inspiration from that, today's episode of Typically Tuesdays is a little bit different, I guess. I'm going to be reading short stories and poetry written by Palestinian authors. So you're not really going to be hearing a lot of my voice in the kind of like conceptual sense today. And as well, our playlist is a playlist from Palestine and the Palestinian diaspora. For no particular reason at all. There's no reason why I'm doing this for the program today. But yeah, that is what's going to be happening. A pretty straightforward and simple program. Here we go, here is Tan Tan by Donna Salah. زي عنبر لبس العقول الماضي بيبقى قصص مفتوحة من دون الوقول بلكي بخبي بلكي تأني بلكي بليل ويوم رح تقعد مستني تتمنى ترجعني وانا فندن بلا مول
تهدم انفاقت ملح الجرح وتقطع الساق تبطل تهتم تبطل تشتاق تعطل القلب تتخطى الافراق تتهنى في الباقص تنساش بقرص الدرس في فلاش باك قلب اتعتم فلت الاسلاك ادراج جناحه لونه اسود سمه بتودى
بلكي بخبي بلكي تأني بلكي بستنى الدور بلكي اللي بيسألني مش خايف من شري وانا بدن
طريق الرجاء
ويلا نخلي الماضي مدفون، لا عقلي مفتوح لا قلبي مرهون.
Tuned in to Typically Tuesdays here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie. This episode of Typically Tuesdays is heavily inspired by Radio Al-Hara's 12-hour programming for Palestine, which was called Until Liberation. You can find that on Google. I'm taking a page from them. Kind of just using my voice to amplify the voices of Palestinian artists, writers, thinkers. Today in the first part of the show, I'm going to be reading from a collection of short stories called Kasat. It's edited by Joe Glanville, published in 2007 by Telegram. If you go on the internet and you look up that name, it's gonna come out with a longer title, and is gendered, and I want to mention that because since the publishing of that book, there have been authors that have come out not as women. And here forward, I'm only going to be referring to that collection as Kasat. I'm doing this to honor the identities of the people who aren't women, who are involved in writing the collection, and to also share their writing because I think it's really brilliant and I think people should get onto it. This is a story called My Shoe Size and Other People's Views on the Matter by Nibal Tawabde. I'm free. I feel I'm saved at last. I throw my drained body into the safe little spot I've escaped to from the world of endless continents and lodge myself there securely. It is the realm of my size, though it barely contains me. I open my eyes as never before and shake my head from side to side with wild abandon. The stories and fingerprints of yesterday fall away with my curls. As silent as love, granules of sweat roll down my face like kind fairies bringing relief for a moment in childbirth. I hold my head high like a flag that has long hung half-mast, but is hoisted up and flown with pride and victory by its children. With both my hands, I smooth out the map of my life and call in a weary voice that barely reaches my ears. I'm free. I look down at my feet, like an old invalid stunned by the sudden ability to walk. I rejoice like a child receiving a doll on a feast day and say to myself, I'm reborn. I feel as fresh as peppermint, as though I was born yesterday. My memory is as pure and clear as a pool of water, untouched by the blowing breeze. I stand before the world in dumb bewilderment, as though I've stumbled upon a whole new existence. The day before me is a blend of Eve's life in the Stone Age and her life in this age of nothingness. I run my hand along the contours of my body from the northernmost point to the southernmost tip and shout in that same voice you cannot hear, for I can barely hear it myself. I can fly. The horse of my childhood dream, I see myself riding it now. True to the dream, we gallop on and on over level ground until we reach our destination. I hear nothing but the sound of hooves. I see nothing but the never-ending horizon, dyed the yellow of sunflowers, the red of my lips. I feel nothing but a quivering desire to embrace life. I know for sure that I can fly and won't be brought down. I'm liberated. I won't be shackled. I'm reborn and won't die again. I have awoken and won't slumber anymore. The awakening may have come late, but what matters is that it has come at all. I think the circumstances that drew me to him and him to me, in the same unexplained way we come into the world and the world comes to us. This afternoon, I walked vainly down Jerusalem's Madbasseh Street and entered his store. The world was ablaze with people and sweat poured forth from every direction. "What size?" asked the young man, his mind on one customer, his eyes on another, his hands serving a third. I quickly lowered myself onto a chair, then leapt up as its scorching leather seat stung me. There, in the large mirror in front of me, my action was reflected life-size. Struggling to overcome my confusion, I somehow managed to keep up my princess-like manners. 38, please. The young man, and an expert in women's fittings and shoe sizes, turned around and concentrated his full attention on me. Really? His disdain brought the vile, invisible walls that had encircled me for so long tumbling down. I could hear them collapsing. I watched him size me up and suddenly no longer knew myself. What size am I, actually? I asked myself. The man moved off, passing me, my distraction and my shock. He disappeared and then returned with the shoes in the style and size I had requested. I took the shoes, undid the laces. Memories brought back the past. I recalled how each time I bought shoes in size 38, I would walk around in pain for a time, then eventually throw them into the cupboard stuffed with shoes of all styles and colors, all of which are 38s. My feet are size 39, I told myself, not 38. So why had I insisted on buying size 38 all this time? The answer lay folded carefully in a corner of Amal, Sana, Samia, and Ida's special girls' meetings. We would all brag our feet were the smallest, the presumption, of course, being that there was a direct connection between shoe size and a girl's grace and femininity. I'd boast outrageously I was a 38, then fall quiet for a while, and occasionally admit warily that I was really a 39. According to this theory, Samia was the most feminine and elegant of us all, as she wore size 36, the size always on display in shop windows. We would undress in front of shop windows to discover the truth. I stood for a long time in front of the windows of Bennington in Washington, lost in thought. How much truth was really imparted there? If my coloring was black, would the mirror receive me kindly? Or do we only stand in front of mirrors that flatter us? Once, in a childish moment, exhausted by shoe sizes and walking bare feet in the desert of my life, I complained to my mother about the size of my feet. She gave me an adequate answer. But I was not satisfied. It's all proportionate. Sami is only 155 meters tall, so she's petite and has small feet. You're 170, so you have a bigger build and larger feet. I dismissed my mother's justifications, unconvinced and without giving her analysis much thought. I stuck with my own categorization. I'm a size 38, I thus convinced myself. It is incredible what we can make ourselves believe when we want to, in a sense selecting what we expose ourselves to, what we comprehend and remember. How we embrace some things and close our eyes to others, and explain our visions from our own perspective. How we forget what we should really remember. In some ways, my relationship with this theory resembles my relationship with my mother. Today, in my simple discovery, having shed all former experience and sat as a spectator watching the film of my memories, I realize I could have been doing this all my life because I wanted to get as close as I could to the standard people set for the feminine ideal. Whenever I buy shoes, I would ask for size 38s, then suffer from the new shoes for at least a month until they softened or stretched, either this or I threw them into my pile of 38 size shoes because they were one size too small, but one step closer to the feminine ideal. The disapproval of the man in the shop shook me, my innermost being, and all the hang-ups about my feet I've accumulated over the years, my conviction about the shoe size, as it were. The situation stunned me. A lifetime of immense suffering and trivial self-consciousness about my feet. Why? How did this happen to me? Are there other measurements I should wear or should not wear? Should I expect another shock to shake me into discovering that some other part of my unconsciousness is leading me unawares? And you? Do you wear the right size? As this young man who entered my life for a fleeting moment, like a billboard that flaps every minute as I pass in the car, why did he appear today? Why hasn't he ever said, size 38? Really? Before? Why didn't anyone else who saw me limping in tiny shoes intervene? Why didn't anyone simply say, take off your shoes and you'll feel a lot better, take them off and walk barefoot? And me! How was I able to purchase hundreds of pairs of ill-feeling shoes simply because they were nearer to the feminine ideal? Perish my idiot shoes, and perish the standards set for femininity and beauty. All my life I have suffocated my toes in shoes that are not suitable because the size is wrong. Do you think I can make it up to my feet by walking barefoot for the rest of my life and never yielding to shoe sizes, styles, and colors again? I pause with deference and humility and offer my deepest apologies to my toes and the balls of my feet, which have swollen from the pressure. I leave the shop wearing a new pair of size 39s with my old tiny ones under my arm. I decide to hang them in a prominent place in my house. Perhaps I will think of a creative way of displaying them that will not enhance their beauty or bring them any admiration. I'll put them somewhere I can see them, so I will never forget that lifetime of discomfort, swollen soles and squashed toes born out of my insistence for a size that was too small, but that would provide the opportunity for people to regard me as feminine. Here's more music. Here is Prozac by Dom.
شلوم شلوم بديش هالشاكل بوقف ع حقي بديش الكرسي بديش الكناسه خد ليبراليتك وحشيها الزرق في ثقوب في قناعكم الابيض اوكي كي كي
اي اي تعت نشوف انا المنكوب فانا المندوب نايس تو ميت يو انا علوش هاد منجيل هاد منكوش عنا عذاب بدها قلع من الشروش بس ما كان بينا ولا دعدوش قبل بوش
شو أقول؟ الله أكبر؟ واتفجر؟ من سبونسر؟ نفاق شغل عداد الإرهاب سبقين الكل بالكيلومتراج يمن عراق هيروشيما صومال باكستان سوريا وأفغانستان لا تكتب لي روشتا
بديش تعطيني بروزا
كأبتي وحرة فيها
mind your business عقلنا
لحالي بتألم
لحالي بتألم
قسمني وقطعني بلفور شلحني وشردني كله مستورد كله مستورد شغل اجنبي وانا بستنى وانا بستنى صنع بلدي علو علو التصفيق علو علو التهليل رحبوا في لورنس الانجليز هذا بطل هذا اديس لورنس العرب هو لقب مستعرب قديم مستعرب اسرائيل ولقب مستعرب حديث رحبوا يلا ارقصوا مع الرئيس الاحمق افردوا لبساط الاحمر اهدوا اهدوا الماظ الكوكب
يضربني بالصرمه
شو سيناريو حقوق مرأة نفاق الشوفينية مش شرقية بل ذكورية كل واحد ودوره أنا بعالج قضية الشرف وانت عالج عندكم صناعة البورنو لا تكتب لي روشتة
بديش تعطيني بروزا
كأبتي وحرة فيها
mind your business عقلنا
back to Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie, and today we're reading Palestinian writing on the radio by Palestinian writers for no particular reason at all. Here's an excerpt of a story by Rhonda Girar called Barefoot Bridge. This was a story published in 2007, I just really love the humor in it. Girar is very good at humor writing. Here we go. We're on our way to Palestine, which Baba calls the bank, El Dafa, to bury my Baba's Baba. We'll have to fly to Jordan, then drive to this Dafa and cross a bridge. On the airplane, I take out a map from the pocket in the seat in front of me, and on it, Palestine is the country stuck to Egypt. So I ask Baba, why can't we just drive there or take a plane straight there? He tells me to be quiet and fasten my seatbelt before the stewardess comes and kicks me off the plane. I remember that his Baba died and I should really be quiet. I want to hold his finger like the times we walked along the beach next to our apartment, the mud squishing underneath our sandals, my hand wrapped around his hairy finger. When the plane is in the sky, my ears feel like there's a person inside my head pulling at them with a string. Gamal must feel this way too, because he's crying and throwing a fit. In Jordan, we take a taxi from the airport to the border. Baba sits next to the driver and looks straight ahead. I look at all around me, at the rocks sticking out of the mountains that fly past us, and the sand, and the green trees lining the road. We go down a mountain, and my ears finally pop. I feel like we're on a roller coaster, except we have windows. I ask Mama for some paper and a pen, and she fishes them out of her bag. I'd like to draw what I see, the leather in the seat in the taxi, the cucumber sandwich my brother half ate, Baba's stubble, the dry skin around his eyes, Mama's lipstick-lined mouth, her face, the faces of the rocks outside, the wind whipping in through the window. I realize I can't draw all these things, so I make a list of them. I don't write numbers or anything, just list the things I'd like to record. After I'm done, I give Mama the sheet of paper, and she folds it in half without looking at it. Now I wish the wind would whisk the list I made and place it in Baba's lap. Then he'd open it up and read it, and he'd feel better. Mama brings out a brush from her giant purse, which holds 5 years' worth of receipts and eyeliners, and she brushes my hair impatiently. I want to say, "Ouch, it's not my fault Baba's Baba died," but I don't. Mama's coral lips twitches as she brushes. I want to make her lips transform into a smile. I'll write funny lists for her. The taxi goes all the way down the mountain, the wind rustling through the glass and whipping through my hair, messing it up again. The car slows down and everyone inside seems nervous. I look ahead and see yellow and black stripes on something that looks like a gate, and there's a soldier there, dressed in green. My father gives him papers, and the man lets us out. We sit with several other families on benches by the road. Mama and Baba don't talk. I just look at the soldier and his shiny rifle. We sit there for a long time, then a bus pulls up next to us and we're allowed to get on. The bodies on the bus sway back and forth, and from where I'm sitting, I can barely see the people's faces. Our bodies look like the dresses and t-shirts I saw a few days ago hanging up on the wires at the market. Two women start talking about what village they're from, and then they smile because they're distant relatives. The driver stops the bus at another yellow and black gate and steps out for a moment. I follow him with my eyes and watch him get a cigarette from the soldier who is coming up the steps. The soldier inspects all our passports with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth. He never takes it off of his lips. I think it's a neat trick, but I'm worried about the long piece of ash hanging from it. When the soldier is done looking at papers, the bus driver gets back onto his seat and drives again. We approach a bridge, and the driver tells us to get off. I ask Baba if this is the bridge, and he nods his head and pats my shoulder. Where we get off, there are many soldiers, boy ones and girl ones, sitting outside a gray building. I walk past a girl soldier and admire her long curly hair tied up in a ponytail. Inside, we stand in a line with our luggage. After maybe an hour, they check our bags, dumping their contents onto the wooden counters, and ask us where we live. Baba answers them, and they zip up the bags and keep them, telling us to sit down and await inspection. I ask Baba how long all of this will take, and he says, "All day," and looks over at the soldier. It looks like he and the soldier are talking, but they're not saying a word. I go to Mama, and she lets me take Gamal from her and so she can rest. He's heavy, and I can feel him farting through his underwear. For a while, Mama, my brother, and I are separated from Baba. We have to go to an area off to the side of the building and take our shoes off. There are many other girls there, and they have their shoes off as well. There are women in pretty dresses, women in jeans, women in veils, women in short skirts, women in traditional dresses with gold bracelets lining their arms and blue tattoos on their chins, women with big bug-eye sunglasses and big purple tint eyeglasses like Mama's, women in khaki shorts and tank tops, all women with no shoes on. Barefoot. It's hot now. The sun in the center of the sky and the roof of the building is made of metal. The girl soldiers tell us to step into the makeshift corridor that separates into rooms resembling fitting closets at a store. The rooms are sealed off with cream-colored fabric. Inside the room, I take my dress off and stand in my white underwear and my pink undershirt. I'm almost naked and barefoot. Mama takes off her skirt and blouse and is left in tight underwear that is meant to tuck her tummy in and a see-through bra. She is also naked and barefoot. The girl soldier, I notice, looks like a boy, and I would think she's a boy if it weren't for her chest. She runs a black machine over Mama's body, and I feel embarrassed for her, who's naked in front of this rough-handed stranger. As though she heard my thought, the stranger brings the machine up to my armpits and runs it all over my body. It feels like a black snake. Then, Mama farts a huge silent fart that stinks up the fitting room and forces the soldier to leave for a few seconds. We giggle, and Mama says, "Give me five," so I do. From the room next to ours, we hear a girl soldier yell, "What's this? Where?" "Bah, Kotex. In her Kotex, yeah." The girl who'd hidden her gold chain in her Kotex stands next to them, her arms crossed over her chest. "I don't have money to pay the tax," she tells them in Arabic. Mama comes out of the room and takes my hand. We go and look for our shoes. They're in a huge laundry bin in the center of the bigger room. I ask Mama why they're there, and she says the soldiers took them and x-rayed them to make sure we weren't hiding anything in them. "Like what?" I asked, dangling the top half of my body over the bin. I find cute sunflower sandals, brown shoes, pretty red shoes, but not my shoes. "Like bombs," Mama says, inspecting her beige heels and grenades. "But," I say, finding one shoe but not the other. "I thought grenades were bigger than a shoe." At last, I find the other one. Exhales a woman in jeans and skinny glasses. "The girl's got more sense than those blind ones." A few minutes later, the entire bin is emptied, yet the woman in the jeans and skinny glasses still haven't found her shoes. "You stole them," she said, pointing at the pretty girl soldier with braces on her teeth. The soldier laughs. "You bitch, you can't take my shoes. You heard me? They're mine." "I didn't take your dirty shoes. Now get back in line and get out." "Who took them then?" "I put them in your goddamn bin and now poof," she clicks her fingers. "Gone. Where are they?"
"Only God knows, lady. Now get in line."
"Don't give me that god shit. I want my shoes." Take them! The soldier screams, hurling the strappy sandals at her. The girl lifts her glasses and examines the heels. Apparently satisfied, she slips them on. Once outside, she says, First my land, now my Gucci's. God damn it! We sit on a bench in the bright sun and search for Baba. In a little while, he reappears and walks over to us with a bottle of water. I want to tell him stories about what just happened, but he says we have to be quiet in case they call our name so we can collect our bags and go. Mama hands me some cookies, which I inhale while black flies buzz around my face and eyes. All around us there are people, people hungry and tired, people waiting. Mama tries to talk to a woman next to her, but Mama's Palestinian dialect is shabby, and the woman is a peasant. Mama tries the Egyptian dialect, and another woman tells her to keep talking, like a movie star. Mama's embarrassed, and stops talking altogether, which suits Baba just fine. When the sun is halfway down in the sky, a soldier yells our name, and Baba crosses the yard and gets our bags from them. We then look for a taxi to take us to Baba's village, Jenin, and find a van of people who are going there too. I sit on Mama's lap this time, and Baba takes my sleeping brother. I watch the ponies as we drive by, the olive trees, the almond trees. I notice how neat the rows of trees are, small sprinklers shooting water at them, and green army jeeps that zoom past us. Baba's face looking like the sliced rocks in the mountain on our left. I'm so tired. I close my eyes, smell the lemony air, and bury my head in his shirt. That was the first part of Rhonda Gerard's Barefoot Bridge, as seen in the collection of stories Kassat, edited by Joe Glanville and published by Telegram. Let's move on to some more music. Here is Walla Forsa by Zayn.
Thank you. different ledge to push me off. How you planned it, oh, how you planned it. You were such a friend.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie, and last part of the program, we're going to be reading poetry by Mahmoud Darwish. He was like the sweetheart of Palestinian literature, and the works that I've selected today are from a collection called A River Dies of Thirst. It was posthumously published, and these are manuscripts that survived a rampaging by the Israeli army of the Sakakini Cultural Center in 2002 in Ramallah. At the cultural center, Darwish actually did a lot of his work there, and so these are works that were kind of salvaged from that trampling. This is a collection put together by Ruth Padell. All right, here's the first one, The Girl, The Scream. On the seashore is a girl, and the girl has a family. And the family has a house, and the house has two windows and a door. And in the sea is a warship having fun, catching promenaders on the seashore. 4, 5, 7, fall down on the sand. And the girl is saved for a while because a hazy hand, a divine hand of some sort, helps her. So she calls out, "Father, father, let's go home. The sea is not for people like us." Her father doesn't answer. Laid out on his shadow, windward of the sunset, blood in the palm trees, blood in the clouds. Her voice carries her higher and further than the seashore. She screams at night over the land. The echo has no echo, so she becomes the endless scream in the breaking news, which was no longer breaking news, when the aircraft returned to bomb a house with two windows and a door. Here's one called The House as Casualty. In 1 minute, the entire life of a house is ended. The house as casualty is also mass murder, even if it is empty of its inhabitants. A mass grave of raw materials intended to build a structure with meaning, or a poem with no importance in time of war. The house as casualty is the severance of things from the relationships and from the names of feelings, and from the need of tragedy to direct its eloquence at seeing into the life of the object. In every object, there is a being in pain, a memory of fingers, of a smell, an image, and houses are killed just like their inhabitants, and the memory of objects is killed. Stone, wood, glass, iron, cement are scattered in broken fragments like living beings, and cotton, silk, linen, papers, books are torn into pieces like proscribed words. Plates, spoons, toys, records, taps, pipes, door handles, fridges, washing machines, flower vases, jars of olives and pickles, tinned food all break just like their owners. Salt, sugar, spices, boxes of matches, pills, contraceptives, antidepressants, strings of garlic, onions, tomatoes, dried okra, rice, and lentils are crushed into pieces just like their owners. Rent agreements, marriage documents, birth certificates, water and electricity bills, identity cards, passports, love letters are torn to shreds just like their owners' hearts. Photographs, toothbrushes, combs, cosmetics, shoes, underwear, sheets, towels fly in every direction like family secrets broadcast aloud in the devastation. All these things are a memory of the people who no longer have them and of the objects that no longer have the people. Destroyed in a minute. Our things die like us, but they are not buried with us. Here is one called Visible Music. When I listen to music gardens open out around me and the melody becomes a flower, I hear with my eyes. Sound has an image, and this image has a sound which slowly gathers momentum like waves, more far-reaching than any literary metaphor. Carnations leave their flower beds and are distributed on the tables of high-class restaurants to compensate a stranger for some forgotten loss, or make a diner waiting for his companion better prepared to face the uncertainties of their encounter. Nobody stops the narcissist, listening for hours to a song of joy in the water and believing it is a song of praise. When white lilies fill a room with their huge, pungent scent, I'm confused by my thoughts about them. The opposite of violets, which make me pause where 2 seconds intersect and dissolve, indistinguishable as the tears shed at weddings and funerals, and the opposite of anemones, which are content with a song on the broad margins, a pastoral on the low mountain slopes. All of this is so I can say the red rose is visible music, and jasmine is a message of longing from nobody to nobody. Here's a poem called My Imagination, a Faithful Hunting Dog. I was on my way to nowhere in particular, a gentle drizzle making me slightly damp, when an apple with no resemblance to Newton's apple fell on me from the clouds. I reached my hand to pick it up, and could neither feel nor see it. I stared up at the clouds, and saw tufts of cotton wool driven northwards by the wind, away from the water tanks crouched on the roofs of the buildings. The light poured brightly down on the asphalt, spreading out gleefully in the absence of pedestrians and cars, and perhaps laughing at my uneven progress. Where is the apple that fell on me? I wondered. Maybe my imagination, which is independent from me, picked up and ran off with it. I said, I will follow it to the house where we live together in adjoining rooms. There, on the table, I found a sheet of paper on which was written in green ink one line. An apple fell on me from the clouds, and I knew my imagination was a faithful hunting dog. Here's a poem called Green Flies. The scene is the same as before. Summer and sweat, and an imagination incapable of seeing beyond the horizon, and every day is better than tomorrow. But the dead are what's new. They're born every day, and when they're trying to sleep, death takes them away from their drowsiness into a sleep without dreams. It's not worth counting them. None of them asks for help from anyone. Voices search for words in the open country, and the echo comes back clearly, woundingly, there's nobody here. But there's somebody who says it's the killer's right to defend the killer instinct. while the dead say belatedly, it's the victim's right to defend his right to scream. A call to prayer rises to accompany the indistinguishable funerals. Coffins hastily raised in the air, hastily buried, no time to carry out the rites, more dead are arriving at speed from other raids, individually or in groups, or a whole family with no orphans or grieving parents left behind. The sky is leaden gray and the sea blue-gray, but the color of blood is hidden from the camera by swarms of green flies. The final one that I will share today is the titular poem of this collection by Mahmoud Darwish, collected by Ruth Bedell. This is A River Dies of Thirst. A river was here, and it had two banks, and a heavenly mother who nursed it on drops from the clouds. A small river moving slowly, descending from the mountain peaks, visiting villages and tents like a charming, lively guest, bringing oleander trees and date palms to the valley and laughing to the nocturnal revelers on its banks. Drink the milk of the clouds and water the horses and fly to Jerusalem and Damascus. Sometimes it sang, heroically, at others passionately. It was a river with two banks and a heavenly mother who nursed it on drops from the clouds. But they kidnapped its mother, so it ran short of water and died, slowly, of thirst. And so that's it. That's all I'll be sharing today on the show from A River Dies of Thirst by Mahmoud Darwish and Kissat by Joe Glanville. By the time that you're listening to this today, the government of Canada would have yet again refused to call for a ceasefire to the bombardment of Gaza by the Israeli government. This is unfortunate and truly atrocious and unspeakably tragic. Of course, not only for us outsiders, but most importantly for the civilians of Gaza and those who love them throughout the world. My call for action to you is to please, if you have not already started, you can get started today. Please use every single civil liberty that you have to continue to talk about Gaza and to tell your local government officials that you will not stand for this. It is unacceptable for these atrocities to continue, and it is unacceptable for Canada to refuse to lift a finger to do anything to help the civilians of Gaza. Canada must call for a ceasefire immediately. Tell your government officials that. Call them. Email them. Do it the old-fashioned way. Write a letter. Please. And if you're able to show up to a protest, practice mindful, safer protesting. And do it. If you have the funds to contribute to a mutual aid for Gaza, do it. We are watching a textbook case of genocide happening before our very eyes, and our governments want to look away. That is unacceptable. Please, please, write to your government officials. Sign every single petition. Call them. Leave voicemails if you have to. But please, do not sit on your hands. Do not zip your lips. There is no complex issue in watching children, entire families, entire residences get wiped out by one of the world's most powerful armies. It's not a complex issue. For the oppressed, for the people of Palestine, please take action. Free Palestine. Check out more great CJSF programming. Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon every Friday from 10 to 11 with your host, Charlotte Sister C. Farrell. 10 to 11 on Friday. Final music of the day. This is by, this is a project called Minkum Oficum by Alquas. for sexual and gender diversity in Palestinian society. They're an organization in Jerusalem, you know, promoting conversations and awareness about sexual and gender pluralism in Palestine. And this is a part of their ongoing project called Singing Sexuality. They're taking music basically to engage with Palestinian youth, to have open discussions about queerness and transness and all that. Minkum Ofikum is their most recent project from 2020, and it's taking traditional Palestinian and Arabic music and giving them a queer twist. So there are four songs in this medley that I'm going to be sharing today. If you want to know more about the track listing of this medley and also more about Singing Sexuality and the work that Alquas does, you can look them up online. That's Alquas, Singing Sexuality, or wait for the episode to be uploaded next week and you can find a link to their stuff in the show notes. And my hope for us is that the sorrow and the rage and the grief that we were holding on to will allow us to become even more hopeful for a brighter future. This has been Leslie for Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'll chat with you next week. Here's Minkum Ofikum by Alquas.
من قوم فيكم من